Today, crunch times around the corner. The DFA Daily to the 12th of August 2020. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour and with a little philosophy on the side. Gold's rout is probably not yet done, according to Bloomberg. Prices plunged below $1,900 an ounce on Tuesday, extending the precious metal's slump into a second day after it collapsed more than 5% in the week's opening session. After setting a record above $2,000 an ounce last week, gold's rally has come to a juddering halt as US bond yields advanced, eroding the haven's appeal. The swift drop followed modest outflows from gold-backed exchange-traded funds and a 15-day run in overbought territory for the relative strength index. Gold has been on a tear in 2020, and the reversal represents a challenge for the metals backers. The traditional haven has been favoured as the pandemic pummeled the global economy, prompting central banks and governments to deploy unprecedented stimulus. On Monday, Double Line Capital's Jeffrey Gordlash said he expects gold to keep trading higher despite the setback. Spot gold sank as much as 2.1% to $1,872 an ounce and traded at $1,883 at 10:11 a.m. in Singapore. Gold futures also tumbled on the COMEX, while silver dropped sharply. Benchmark Treasury yields have climbed more than 10 basis points so far this month amid improved risk appetite and an imminent flood of debt issuance. The recent rebound reflects investor hopes that the coronavirus will be contained amid Russia's vaccine, according to Standard Chartered. But of course, gold may come back up again, and in fact, in the last couple of hours, it looks as though it has moved slightly higher. But as I keep saying, it is not as predictable as many were talking about. So we'll see what happens ahead. And elsewhere, the shortcomings of JobKeeper are coming out now. As the Fin Review reports, retailers received millions of dollars in federal government wage subsidies from the emergency $102 billion JobKeeper program, helped to lift profits and to pay significantly increased dividends to shareholders. Government stimulus payments to individuals and $30 billion in superannuation withdrawals are also propping up consumer spending, boosting retailer profits and shareholder returns. Adairs CEO Mark Rowan said COVID-19 has boosted online sales, which would have long-term benefits for the company. More than 6% of people who received stimulus payments said that they'd mainly spent the windfall, particularly on bills, furnishings, household equipment, food, recreation, clothing and footwear, according to an Australian Bureau of Statistics survey, which was published on Monday. Manchester and homeware retailer Adairs reported a 19% increase in net profit to $35.3 million after a boom in online sales in Australia and New Zealand during the COVID-19 lockdowns. Adairs joins fellow JobKeeper recipient furniture retailer Nick Scully in increasing shareholder payments. Adairs received $11.3 million in wage subsidies from JobKeeper and the equivalent New Zealand scheme during the program's first 3 months, and the company is on track to receive millions more over the initial six-month JobKeeper program. After cancelling its interim dividend in March to preserve cash, Adairs lifted its final dividend by 37.5% to $18.6 million, or an 11 cents a share. Chief Executive Mark Rowan said Adairs temporarily closed all physical stores in April, and JobKeeper was aimed at supporting stood-down staff. We have to remember that before JobKeeper was announced, to maintain the health and safety of our team and customers, we stood down our entire workforce in Australia, with the exception of those maintaining the online business and the warehouse supporting that, he said. The positive of that is a lot of that has flowed through into the economy and made sure we've continued to see good consumer spending. And last week, furniture retailer Nick Scali said it received $3.9 million under JobKeeper and the New Zealand scheme. In addition, it received rent relief from more than 85% of its landlords, worth another $2.3 million. And last month, K&S Corporation posted a five-fold increase in net profit on the back of $12.4 million in JobKeeper subsidies. This scheme benefits bigger companies. Now, Labour MP and Shadow Assistant Treasurer Stephen Jones said on Tuesday the significantly higher dividend payout by retailers Nick Scali and Des does not pass the pub test. Mr. Jones told the Australian Financial Review that Labour supported JobKeeper, but the increased dividends paid by recipient companies to shareholders undermines confidence in the whole scheme. JobKeeper was designed to help businesses retain workers, not boost dividends, he said. Business investment has fallen off a cliff. Unemployment is forecast to grow by another 400,000 by Christmas. Taxpayers won't cop this, he said. Australians will see this as a rort, and they are right. This is simply corporate welfare, which is neither fair nor affordable, Greens Treasury spokesman and former investment banker Peter Wish-Wilson said. This was always a warped scheme, and the better design would have been a more direct, universal, basic level of support direct to households, but no, big business is being propped up to their expense. And meanwhile, COVID is slowly killing our CBDs, if research from Roy Morgan is accurate. A special analysis of movement data in Australia's capital city CBD shows movement levels are well below those seen earlier in the year in all six state capitals. Movements in both the Perth and Adelaide CBDs are closest to the pre-COVID levels. Movements in late July have returned to around 71% of the levels earlier in the year during January and February. The Queensland capital is ranked third, with movement levels in the Brisbane CBD at 61% of pre-COVID levels, just ahead of the Hobart CBD at 59%. The two laggards are Australia's largest cities and most impacted by the second wave of COVID-19. Movement in the Sydney CBD has dropped to just under half of the pre-COVID-19 levels at 48%, while Melbourne CBD, which entered stage 3 lockdown in early July, was only 27% of its pre-COVID rate. This movement data was drawn before Melbourne entered the more restrictive stage 4 lockdowns last week, where Morgan had partnered with Uber Media to aggregate data from tens of thousands of mobile devices to assess the movements of Australians. 3 weeks into the second lockdown, movements in Melbourne are only 27% of average levels and is set to plunge further in August, as the city has now entered an even more restrictive stage 4 lockdown set to run until at least mid-September. Over the next few weeks, the disparity in movements around Australia is likely to increase as Victoria is effectively quarantined from the rest of the country as it fights to regain control of the largest outbreak of COVID-19. And the ABS reported weak wages growth today. According to the ABS, wages grew by just 0.22% in the June quarter, and private sector wages grew by only 0.08%, whereas public sector wages grew by 0.58%. It was wages in the public sector that helped hold wage inflation positive in the quarter, but this was not enough to prevent the annual pace moderating to 2.1% across the year from 2.4%. In the release, the ABS noted that the pressure on wages was most acute in the informal sector. There were reported wage increases for jobs with scheduled increases, such as enterprise agreements and award-based jobs, offset by falling wages for jobs in the informal sector. The rise of the informal sector has increased Australian wage sensitivity to the economic cycles, as of course we saw during the mining boom and through the GFC. And so an extreme economic event now produces a more extreme wage outcome. The COVID-19 pandemic resulted in a large number of private sector businesses reporting genuine market-based reductions in wages paid under individual agreements. These agreements are more sensitive to labour market conditions. And the ABS also noted the June quarter wage price index reported a higher proportion of wage reductions for managers and professional roles than for other occupations. And then at an industry level, the ABS noted that professional, scientific, technical services, construction and rental hiring and real estate services had the highest proportion of wage reductions. Overall, for the private sector, wages fell down 0.9% for other services, 0.5% for professional, scientific and technical services, and 0.5% in construction. Breaking it down further, the ABS also noted that the strongest wages growth was in South Australia, up 0.4%, and that was due to the public sector, while in Western Australia, it was based on moderate private sector growth of 0.2%. An offsetting fall was in Victoria, down 0.1%, where falling private sector wages more than offset moderate public sector growth, down 0.1%. This is the first negative wage print ever reported in any state, not even WA, in the depths of the post-mining boom collapse, generated a negative quarter of statewide wages growth. Ahead, wage growth will obviously remain weak or non-existent as mass unemployment remains across the economy. Now, across the ditch, as new COVID cases emerged in Auckland after more than 100 days without community transmission, forcing a further lockdown, the Reserve Bank New Zealand via the Monetary Policy Committee agreed to expand the large-scale asset purchase program up to 100 billion New Zealand dollars so as to further lower retail interest rates in order to achieve its remit, they said. The eligible assets remain the same and the official cash rate will be held at 0.25% in accordance with the guidance they issued back in March. Reflecting a possible need for further monetary stimulus, the committee also agreed that a package of additional monetary instruments must remain in active preparation. The deployment of such tools will depend on the outlook for inflation and employment. The package of further instruments include a negative official cash rate, supported by funding retail banks directly at near OCR, a funding for lending program, if you like. Purchases of foreign assets also remain an option. And then noted that members discussed the implications of alternative monetary policy tools for financial stability. The discussion covered the tools that are being considered, noting the lessons and experience from other central banks and considering the calibration of a package of monetary instruments. The committee agreed that a lower or negative official cash rate, a funding for lending program, purchasing of foreign assets and interest rate swaps all provided policy options. But they held, of course, the OCR at 0.25% for now. And finally, CBA released their full year results with a second half cash net profit after tax and continuous operations of $2.94 billion, which was 5% lower than our expectations. And those results were impacted by higher one-offs from aircraft leasing impairments and customer remediation. The CBA recorded a $7.3 billion full-year cash net profit after tax, and that's down 11.3%. But their impairment charges, whilst large, were lower than I'd expected. Net interest margin was much weaker too, down 7 basis points, half over half, and with warnings of more compression ahead. However, their capital was stronger than anticipated thanks to recent asset sales, and they announced a second half dividend of 98 cents per share. But there were nasty signs of asset quality deterioration in the half, with impairments lifted to $1.9 billion, up 188% half over half, thanks to COVID-19-related provisions taken in the third quarter. Stressed assets compared to total exposures increased from 0.72% to 0.78%. This is mainly due to corporate troublesome assets, they said. But there were signs of trouble in their credit card books. While they reported 135,000 active repayment deferrals, equivalent to $48 billion, which is 8% of their mortgage book. This was down from 154,000 at the peak. Business loan deferrals were 15% of their book, 59,000, down from 86,000 at the peak. And they called out trouble in various industry sectors like retail. One other point, management noted that CBA had recognised approximately $310 million of interest related to retail loans in deferral, and that they were receiving some payment on 25% of these loans and approximately $150 million of interest related to non-retail loans in deferral, and that they received full payment on about 30% of these loans. In other words, higher loan balances, which were not being paid down, lifted profit, weirdly. Now, APRA's hand is here, of course, with their blessing. Loans missing payments are not currently classed as non-performing, and dividend payments are lower as the bank is forced to retain earnings. The real rubber will hit the road after September. I still expect higher for sales ahead by the bank pressing people who have income issues continuing to consider selling. So not a for sale in the traditional sense, but nevertheless, it's a for sale. And by the way, CBA are expecting a U-shaped recovery, no V-shape in sight here, which aligns to our view of what's ahead, bearing in mind that COVID is still raging, and I think we have more to play out there at the moment. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.